And welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Marty Moskowain. What makes people successful in school and life? Is it about IQ, socioeconomic status, quality of schooling, genetics, good looks? Education journalist and author Paul Tough argues it's mostly about character, determination, grit, the will to fall down and get back up again. Paul Tough joins us in the studio to discuss his new book, How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. Paul, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Paul, before we get to this book, I want to talk a little bit about your previous book, which was called Whatever It Takes, because I think it's part of this body of work. So talk about that and what you were writing about.
Sure. So Whatever It Takes came out back in 2008, and it's about a man named Jeffrey Canada and his organization, the Harlem Children's Zone. And the Harlem Children's Zone is a unique, especially when I started writing about it 10 years ago, a really unusual approach to dealing with neighborhoods of poverty, and especially with children in those neighborhoods. What Jeff is trying to do is combine both educational supports for kids with supports outside of the classroom. So if you're a kid who lives in the Harlem Children's Zone, which is a 97-block neighborhood in central Harlem, you have access to your parents have access to parenting programs, you have access to a health clinic, a farmer's market, after-school programs, help with college applications. And as well, he runs a couple of charter schools that are sort of at the center of the zone.
And what did you see there that sparked your interest in this issue of character and what it takes? What did you see in these kids and the programs?
Well, what I think is smart about the Harlem Children's Zone is that they really do everything. But for a journalist, what is kind of a problem about that is that it's hard to tell like what it is in that whole matrix of programs that Jeff Canada provides for those kids that are the ones that are working. And so I found myself as I was finishing my reporting and as the first book came out, that I still had a lot of questions about how children succeed, about what kind of qualities and experiences tend to lead kids towards success or failure. And around the same time, I also had my own first child. So suddenly these questions, which had been more sort of journalistic and theoretical before, suddenly took on a really personal element for me.
Now, talk about your new book. These were some of the issues, what it takes, that you wanted to now kind of focus in. So who were the people you sought out? Who were the people you were interested in?
So the questions that I was trying to answer were these pretty big and at least to me, very mysterious questions about who succeeds and who fails, why it is that some kids do well and some kids don't, and especially why it is that kids in low-income neighborhoods and low-income families are less likely to succeed than others. And I think as well, what we can do to help kids succeed, whether we're talking about our own children or a whole generation of children. And so as I started to kind of follow two tracks at once, one is that I went and reported on people who were actually working directly with kids, a lot of educators, teachers, but also medical doctors and mentors of various kinds. And at the same time, I started looking at the science to try to find out what we really know about how children succeed. And what struck me was that there was this, what I felt was a very important conversation going on out of the public eye, and it was very different than the traditional educational debate. And they were these scientists, including neuroscientists, economists, were focused on this very different set of skills. So I think that, you know, like most people, I believed when I started this reporting that the skills that mattered most in a child's success were IQ. You know, I think most of us think it's this kind of narrow band of cognitive skills, what gets measured on standardized tests, that makes a difference in terms of whether kids succeed or whether kids fail. And these scientists whose work I started reading are arguing for something very different. They're saying that it is skills like grit, like curiosity, perseverance, optimism, self-confidence, conscientiousness, that these make a huge difference in whether kids succeed or whether they fail, at least as much as IQ and possibly more. And so that was the direction that I took the book. And I started to find lots of interventions that were working on those same skills. And what's complicated about these skills is we don't yet really know how to teach them. You know, there is a pretty clear cause and effect with certain interventions, you know, when you're talking about reading and math. But when you're talking about these other skills, it gets more complicated.
And to make matters probably even more complicated, how do we define success? And how do you define it? How do we as a country define it? What is success?
It's a good question. I actually think that you know, the definition of success that I'm using in this book, and that the scientists who I'm writing about are using, is not in itself all that revolutionary. I think I'm talking about having a rich, deep, happy, fulfilling life. And I think that involves a lot of material markers of success, things like educational attainment, a good salary. But I think it also includes more nuanced elements like just a sort of sense of satisfaction and fulfillment. What I think is really new about the research that these scientists are doing is the skills and the skills that are required to get there and the conditions that help develop those skills.
And in terms of policy, what are we focusing on as a country when it comes to education? How do we define successful children? What do we want our children to be able to do?
Well, I think if you talk to most teachers or parents these days, they would say that the sort of effective policy we have through No Child Left Behind in the Bush administration and now Race to the Top in the Obama administration is about standardized tests, that really what we're trying to do is increase kids' scores on standardized tests. And standardized tests measure a pretty narrow band of cognitive skills. And so I think what that means is that, you know, even when I think teachers and parents sort of instinctively know that their kids need more than those skills, if you're being judged on, if a school is being judged on, if a teacher is being judged on, if a child is being judged on how well they do on those tests, it's hard to you know, teachers aren't incentivized to teach this other stuff. And especially given the fact that it's complicated to figure out how to teach it, I think we're really not emphasizing it in our education system.
We're speaking with education journalist Paul Tough. He has a new book which is called How Children Succeed. And if you want to join our conversation, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Maybe you're working with children or you have children and are wondering how you can instill some of these qualities that Paul has mentioned so far in the children. So let's break apart some of these kind of character traits that you describe in the book. Grit keeps coming up. What is grit, and do we have it? Are we born with it? Can we learn it?
So, you know, Philadelphia is kind of the international
grit
center
capital.
Of grit. It's the grit capital of the world, because the scholar who has really sort of identified it as a psychological trait is Angela Duckworth,
yes,
who is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania.
And she was on Radio Times. I want to remind our listeners, if you want to listen back to that conversation, it's in our archives. But yes, Angela Duckworth has written a lot about grit.
She has. And so, you know, she kind of coined the term. I mean, it's a word that's been around for a long time, and there's sort of the John Wayne meaning.
And grit, right.
Exactly. I think she's trying to turn that into a psychological category that we can actually measure. And the way she defines it is it involves some sense of self-discipline, but it also involves a sense of passion. It's about perseverance in the pursuit of a particular passion. So it's people who just have a very clear goal and don't let any obstacle get in their way as they're trying to achieve that goal. And Angela invented this thing called the grit test or the grit scale, and it is an 8-question test, this really simple test, one-sentence questions about how likely you are to stick with a task, how likely you are to get distracted from a task. And she's found two things. One is that people are pretty honest when they fill out this test, and so in, you know, 5 minutes you can give someone a pretty good sense of your grit, and that your score on the grit test is actually very predictive of a whole lot of outcomes. So she gave it to first-year students at the University of Pennsylvania, and it helped predict how well they would do in school. She gave it to young kids who were in the National Spelling Bee, and it helped predict what round these kids would last to. And then most amazingly, she gave it to cadets at West Point who were entering this grueling first-year induction program called Beast Barracks. And the thing I like about her Beast Barracks story is that the Army had already invented this extremely complicated series of tests to predict, you know, how likely different cadets were to make it through Beast Barracks. And Angela's 8-question test turned out to be a better predictor than the Army's complex test.
Are we born with a certain amount of grit? Do we learn it later? If I'm reflecting on my own childhood, I think I was totally gritless, but I feel like I've gotten more grit as I've gotten older.
Well, I think so. Angela, I think, is still figuring out exactly how we develop grit. But my sense of it is that maybe some of it is inborn, but a lot of it is developed through experience. And I think especially it's developed through experiencing failure and setbacks and learning how to overcome them. And in fact, so some of the educators who I talked to who were very concerned about the grit of their students felt like this was a problem, especially in some high-achieving schools, that their kids didn't have enough grit, and they didn't have enough grit because they were too protected. That grit really comes from dealing with some serious adversity.
Yeah, I have interviewed a professor of business who said when he gets kids at his college, which was Villanova, they have never failed at anything. So they are completely astonished. They've never been rejected in a single sports team. They have never been told, you know what, you're not a good singer. I hate to tell you this. It just doesn't really happen anymore. Right. So that's something that educators reflected with you as well.
They did. And so the intervention that I wrote about at length in this book that Angela is actually a part of is at these two different schools in New York City, the Kipp Infinity School, which is a charter middle school serving mostly low-income kids, and Riverdale Country School, which is a very exclusive private school where tuition starts at $40,000 a year. And the leaders of these two schools felt like on paper, they were doing great with their kids. They were getting high test scores. They were getting kids to college. But they felt like there was something missing in their kids' education. So they connected with a few different psychologists, including Martin Seligman, also at the University of Pennsylvania, and then ended up working intensely with Angela to try to figure out how to instill these qualities in their kids. And grit is a big part of what they're trying to teach.
And to follow up, you know, we mentioned kids who have been too protected, have not been allowed to fail. On the other side of the economic spectrum, a lot of times we have kids who have so much adversity that I'm wondering if it squashes the quality of grit in them because they just get knocked down too much. There are too many obstacles. Does that kind of destroy that quality because you have to get up so many times?
Yeah, I think it absolutely does. I think it's the one sort of danger of talking about, you know, grit being developed through failure and talking about qualities like resilience. I think we can have this kind of romantic notion that if you grow up in a really rough neighborhood, you just develop these great character strengths. And you can, certainly, and the experience of having, you know, living through that adversity and triumphing over it, I think really does create grit and other character strengths. But for many kids in those neighborhoods, and I spent a lot of time reporting, especially on the south side of Chicago, and yeah, there's no shortage of adversity for those kids. But they're absolutely damaged by it. They're really beaten down by it.
We're going to have a short break in a moment. We're talking with Paul Tuff. He has a new book called How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. And we're going to talk more about that book. And we're hoping to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Again, our number is 1-888-477-9499. Weigh in. Maybe you're working with children, have some ideas about education and what helps kids succeed. Or if you're a parent and are wondering how you can instill certain qualities in your children. We're hoping to hear from you and we'll be right back here on Radio Times.
The Chemical Heritage Foundation, Library, Museum, Center for Scholars, supports WHYY. This first Friday, September 7th, CHF examines the art and science of herbal medicine, from folk traditions to current wisdom. Visitors can learn about varieties and uses of medicinal herbs and watch a live demonstration from Herbiary, a Philadelphia purveyor of organic plant medicines. CHF's newest exhibit, The Alchemical Quest, will also be on display. More online at chemheritage.org/firstfridays.
Cool season grasses often need a little help at the end of summer, especially this summer. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal the secrets of successfully overseeding an existing but patchy lawn, plus answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
I'm Ray Suarez. Coming up on America Abroad, the number one thing that either Obama or Romney needs to do to help the world is to help the American economy.
4% of Americans believe that foreign affairs is an important part of the campaign decision for them this year.
The next president, foreign policy challenges on the next America Abroad from Public Radio International.
Tonight at 11 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowain, and we're talking with education journalist Paul Tough about his new book, How Children Succeed and Questions of Character, and basically what's in us, Paul, is at the essence of the book, what helps us to succeed. Let's take a call. We have Elliot joining us from West Mount Airy. Hi, Elliot. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I haven't read Paul's book. I have purchased it to buy it, but I wanted to ask a couple of things and make some comments as a longtime educator. I think that there's a couple of things about the skills he's talking about that why kids don't learn them. One of them is the way we motivate and interest kids. So, for example, you have some kids who might be very persevering when it comes to sports, but not necessarily when they're in a boring classroom. Another is how we engage kids. A third is whether we do work long-term with kids so that they can develop problems over time where they get frustrated, where they have to overcome the obstacles. The fact that we only have one kind of assessment program in schools instead of multiple assessments, and the need for mentoring. We need to have kids mentored and go through internships and go through things like that to develop those skills. So that's a rough, quick idea. I didn't want to take too much time, but I'd like to get some of his comments.
All right, Elliot, thank you so much for that call. And Paul, maybe let's start with the theme of mentoring, which plays a big role in your book.
So what Elliot said is really interesting, that because I think there are a lot of kids who are able to get really motivated by things outside of the classroom, and sports teams. He mentioned coaches, and I think coaches are for many athletic coaches are for many people exactly that kind of mentor who creates that kind of of motivation in kids, or helps develop that kind of motivation in kids. I write in my book about a chess teacher at a middle school in Brooklyn who does an amazing job at getting these kids who you wouldn't necessarily think are going to be chess champions, getting them to focus incredibly hard, want to win, and they're the best middle school chess team in the country. And so I'm with Elliot for the most part in this idea that, you know, some kids are going to be more motivated in things outside the classroom. At the same time, I feel like there's potentially something a little bit dangerous in saying, like, okay, this kid's just, like, really into football, so that's what he should keep doing. Because, you know, or chess, or, you know, playing the violin, all those things are great. But I think that what's missing is trying to turn that same kind of motivation and intensity into the classroom. Because it is true that the stuff we learn in the classroom has a lot more relevance and impact in the rest of our life. For most of us, anyway, those of us who don't become professional chess players or football players.
And another thing Elliot brought up is the issue of curiosity. So where do we get that from? How is it fostered inside of the classroom and outside of the classroom?
One of the things I think we don't know enough about how to make kids more curious. I think there are some great teachers who are able to, you know, I think when teachers are able to pull back a little bit, give kids more freedom and room to investigate things and not have to be tested on them all the time, that certainly helps with curiosity. But some of the research that I'm most interested in suggests that a lot of a child's curiosity is developed in the very earliest years of life.
How early?
In you know, before we really have a chance to be curious, in the first year of life. I think that the kind of nurturing that a child gets in infancy helps to develop skills like curiosity, confidence, which doesn't mean that teachers can't do a whole lot with that later on, but that a really important base in those skills is formed in the earliest months and years of life.
And what do we know about these early months and years? You talk also in the book a lot about attachment and how important that is for developing a lot of these skills that later help us succeed.
So the science that I was most struck by, I think, in this book was all about the early years. And attachment is sort of in some ways, the positive side of it. The negative side of it is all about stress. And so we have learned a lot in the last decade or so about the often quite terrible impact that too much stress can have on the developing brain. So learning how to deal with stress is a really important part of brain development, and some stress progress is just fine when you're a kid. But for a lot of kids, especially kids who are growing up in adversity, the stress is just everywhere. It's what one scientist calls toxic stress, mm-hmm. When it becomes chronic.
And pediatricians are calling it that now, toxic stress.
And I think it's a very real phenomenon. And you, it affects us. You know, you can see the effects throughout your life. You can actually measure it in terms of brain chemistry and the shape and size of different parts of the brain. It is extremely damaging to kids. What's positive to me about this, the research in the first couple of years of life, is about parental attachment. That if a child, even a child growing up in adversity, has a warm, connected relationship with an adult, a parent, or other caregivers, what psychologists call a secure attachment, that child is protected from a lot of that kind of adversity. And the attachment study that I read about at most length in the book was one that was done at the University of Minnesota. And these scientists looked at kids in their first weeks of life. And by looking at what kind of attachment relationship these kids had in infancy, it predicted how well they did in kindergarten, how they interacted with their peers at summer camp in middle school, and even who was going to graduate and not graduate from high school.
I mean, a lot of this makes sense, obviously. You know, you think about a child who has a stable relationship, has a stable home. Of course, they're going to do better on some level. But I'm wondering, what does all of this mean then for education? Does it mean that when some children arrive at kindergarten, their chances are just so much worse?
So I think it's a really good question, and I think there's a real risk when we talk about the influence of the home environment in the first few years to then just say, like, you know, throw up our hands and say that if the child doesn't have that by age five, there's no helping him. And that's definitely not true and not at all what I'm trying to say. So I mean, in terms of like education policy, where this research pushes me, I think is in two different directions. One is that I think we should be starting earlier. I think the idea that, you know, the sort of public responsibility for a child starts on the first day of kindergarten and is entirely contained within the walls of the classroom doesn't make a lot of sense, and certainly doesn't correspond with what we've learned about child development, especially for kids growing up in difficult neighborhoods and difficult home situations. There's so much that we could do differently if we could have a bigger influence on their lives in the first few years. So a lot of where I'm hoping that this science will push us is into figuring out how to intervene more with families, how to support families in the first few years of a child's life. And there are some really encouraging interventions out there that I talk about in the book that work closely with parents.
Give us an example.
Well, there are a couple of experiments, one in Oregon and one in Delaware, that try to work with parents who you know aren't naturally oriented towards having an attachment promoting relationship with their kids. Who some of them, you know, have abused their first children, and then they are enrolled in this program, and it's a pretty simple intervention. It's just working in a sort of therapeutic way with these parents. I think it just lasts like 10 weeks, giving them different ideas about how to interact with their kids, different skills in terms of how to deal with stressful situations. And it has a huge impact on not only on their attachment styles with their children, which we know will pay off in a big way later, but actually on the biology of the kid. So that's the thing that's most amazing to me about these interventions, that the interventions are only with the parents, but you can actually measure the effect in terms of like the cortisol levels in the children after the intervention is done. So to me, that's really promising.
And speaking of evaluating these programs and what they actually do, are we doing a good job of it? It seems sometimes we're running off in one direction, and then after a few years, we say, oh no, that's not working, let's try something else. But do we follow children long enough to really understand how something or how some interventions has worked for them?
I was really struck. I mean, I didn't know about any of this research before I really dove into reporting this book. And I was struck by how much is out there, how much really solid science is out there. I mean, it's certainly true that it's not well known enough, I think. And part of the problem, and maybe this is just the way that science works, is that in these different fields, I think people aren't communicating enough. They're starting to now. But you know, it's something that economists are doing, that neuroscientists are doing, that developmental psychologists are looking into. And until recently, at least, they haven't been sharing their research.
And economists are interested in this Why? Because it's an investment? It's pay now, pay later?
So, in some ways, the main, academic in my book is an economist at the University of Chicago, a man named James Heckman, won the Nobel Prize back in 2000. And he is actually trying to pull together all of these different fields. He's worked with Angela Duckworth quite a bit. The reason I think that he and other economists are interested in this stuff is that, you know, skills are really important when you're looking at economics, especially in labor economics. Like, we really need to know how skills are rewarded and how skills are developed. But I think what's interesting is that, you know, that's also what psychologists are trying to figure out. But until recently, the economists and the psychologists hadn't really been talking about how these two things overlapped. And when they did start talking, I think they both found that they were finding something similar, which is that you know, cognitive skills, IQ, which I think in both fields had been thought of as this, you know, very important predictor, was actually not as powerful as it seemed, and that there were these other, you know, what economists call non-cognitive skills, what psychologists call personality traits, there were these other ones that were really important and in some ways more predictive.
Emotional IQ is another buzzword I heard a couple of years ago that seemed to measure the quality of how children can relate to others and how they do in a group setting.
Yeah, so I think that corresponds in this project that I describe in these two schools in New York. They talk about social intelligence. So it's a little bit different than emotional intelligence. It's a little bit more, like management consultant like to talk about social intelligence. But so rather than talking just about empathy and in terms of emotional connections, it's about just how do you read a room? How do you read a group of people, whether it's, you know, seventh grade kids or a business meeting?
We have a lot of people who want to join the conversation. Let's go to Doug from Buckingham. Hi, Doug. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm very interested in education. I do a lot of work with our local school board here trying to improve in the face of a lot of cuts and that type of thing. So I think it's really fascinating thinking about new ways to improve the education is delivered to kids. I have a real specific question, though, and you're talking a lot about grit, G-R-I-T, and I started thinking a lot about quit, Q-U-I-T, and whether there is a quit gene, because I feel like personally sometimes when I was younger, I tended to give in the face of adversity in school and out of school, and I look at my daughter who's 11, and sometimes she has a lot of skills, a lot of talents, but sometimes I see her kind of wilt in the face of that as well when things get tough. I'm trying to figure out how to, you know, keep someone like that motivated without being so overbearing that you crush them, just as you were talking about, where people don't get any negative feedback, and then when they're faced with it, they don't know what to do with it.
And Paul, you talk about in your book about the balance of being there and also letting go as a parent, which is a really tough line to walk. I thank you, Doug, for that call.
Yeah, Doug, I really sympathize with that. My son is just 3, so I haven't had to deal with some of those more intense situations. But I find that fascinating. So, yeah, I think in lots of ways, you know, quit is sort of the opposite of grit. Grit is about not quitting. And so I think that really what you're talking about there is how kids develop grit. So I'm really struck by this idea that it's about how kids develop grit is by being able to fail, really, really being able to take risks, being able to experience true challenge. But I think that it needs to happen in somewhat of a managed way, not too managed, because I think those challenges really do have to be real, and they have to be something that really help kids develop their independence. But I think there's a way. So again, I keep coming back to this chess teacher. There's part of what I think she did that was so effective is she takes kids through their games after they play. So after if you're on the IS 318 team, after each game you have to sit down with the teacher and go through your games move by move. And she's really kind of tough on these kids. You know, she's not sort of saying to them, well, you know, did you try your best? Did you have fun? She's really saying, like, why did you do this? Why did you do that? And chess is full of failure. Like, you know, you lose half your games, you make a ton of mistakes even when you win. And so these kids really experience failure, but she gives them a way to kind of guide them through it, to not let them either beat themselves up too much or to let them just decide, you know, it doesn't matter that I messed up. And I think that experience is incredibly valuable. And so I think it's very difficult to do as parents, But I think that it's this idea of pulling back a little bit, letting kids fail, but also trying to turn that failure into something productive is a crucial part of good parenting.
And something else just to put your mind at ease, Doug, is that I think people may be born with grit and become more grit as they get older. I think it's something that can change over the course of the lifetime. Is that something you experienced, Paul? Maybe even in your own life?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think we get it through experience, and I think we have more experiences as we get older. But I also am struck by the fact I don't think it goes away automatically. The quit impulse. I was struck when I wrote this article for the New York Times Magazine that is sort of expanded into one chapter in the book about these two schools in New York, and when the article came out, it got a lot of reaction on the New York Times website, including from a lot of adults who said, like, yeah, this was me. Like, when I was in high school, I was someone, you know, especially I think people who were in really high-achieving academic environments, I never failed. And so I never had that experience, never had that ability to develop grit and these other, you know, important character strengths. And as a result, now, you know, these were people in their 30s who just said, like, I'm really lost. You know, I didn't get that opportunity to develop these skills. And so I don't know how to deal with adversity now. And everybody's got adversity when they're adults at some point or another.
Let's take another call. We have Anne joining us from Bryn Mawr. Hi, Anne. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to comment. I have worked for the North Carolina Outward Bound School for many years, which is a school that offers experiential educational opportunities. And contrary to what many people think, Outward Bound is not just for troubled youth at all. It really serves across the cultural, economic, and social spectrum. And it offers to its students, it almost guarantees that during the course of their Outward Bound course, they will experience failures. They will be offered an increasingly difficult series of challenges, but they are in a very supportive environment. And because it's experiential learning, it's learning that stays with students, you know, for the rest of their lives. And Paul, I read your article in the New York Times last fall, and there were many times when I thought, he's talking about Outward Bound. He's talking
right.
about Outward Bound.
So this, Carol, I'm sorry, we're coming up on a break, but this issue of character development, obviously at the center of what you do or did.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I'm sorry, we're coming up on a break, Anne, and we're going to reflect in a moment when we come back about your comment, but I want to thank you for your call to Radio Times, and we're taking more calls at 1-888-477-9499 in just a moment, so hang on. Educational journalist Paul Tuff is joining us, and he's talking about his new book, How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character, and we'll be right back on Radio Times here on WHYY.
Philadelphia Live Arts and Philly Fringe supports WHYY and presents its 16th Annual Contemporary Arts Festival, now through September 22nd, featuring local and international theater, dance, music, and visual art events. Spotlight shows include Red Eye to Haverty Grace, an inventive work by Lucidity Suitcase Intercontinental that follows the mysterious last days of Edgar Allan Poe, and Food Court, an experimental piece from Australia's visionary back-to-back theater. Details and tickets at livearts.org.
What's it all about? Alfie.
Hal David said Alfie was his favorite of the lyrics he wrote. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to our interview with Hal David, who wrote many great songs with Burt Bacharach. David died Saturday at the age of 91. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now.
Will new jobs numbers wipe out or add to the president's convention bump? Also, for the first time in nearly a decade, the separatist Parti Québécois has returned to power in Quebec. We'll look at the violence that followed. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking with education journalist Paul Tuff about his new book, How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. And Paul, I was just thinking, what is the role of IQ? We have said how important character is in terms of succeeding and doing well in school and in life, but what is the role of IQ and academic success, some of the traditional measures that we use?
You're right. I need to sort of have as a caveat as I'm talking about these other skills, I do need to say, yeah, IQ is really important. It's if you have a high IQ, it's definitely easier to do all sorts of things. So what I'm trying to argue in the book is that it is not the sole important predictor, and I think we sometimes give it too much emphasis in our culture. The way you asked the question was interesting to me, because you're sort of saying, you know, IQ and academic success. And one of the things that actually Angela Duckworth has discovered is that IQ alone, and if you look at academic success in terms of GPA, that there are other skills that are actually more predictive of GPA than IQ. In one of her first studies, she found that self-control is a better predictor of GPA. IQ is a better predictor of scores on standardized tests, but GPA involves, you know, being able to do a lot of work and get things done and get it done on time, and that doesn't necessarily correlate with IQ.
And when we say self-control, and also another term in the book a lot is self-regulation, what are we talking about?
So scientists use self-regulation, self-control, self-discipline to mean a few different things. But I think that it is just about being able to control your impulses, to regulate your emotions, strong feelings. But also there's kind of cognitive self-control as well. It's being able not to fall into mental traps, to be able to think outside the box a little bit. All of this is part of what self-control is.
And do kids who don't have those skills also get a rough deal sometimes in school, getting labeled maybe with ADHD, with different issues, when that's maybe not the problem?
Yeah, right. So the scientists who study this stuff, I think, are able to show how self-control is developed and how kids get a lack of self-control. And it goes back to some of those stressful situations early in life. I do think we tend to medicalize it. The growth of drugs like Ritalin and Adderall and the diagnoses of things like ADHD. I think in some cases it's absolutely a real medical diagnosis, but we actually know a ton about how the environment creates those sorts of problems in kids. And there are some interventions, including some pre-K and kindergarten interventions, that work really specifically on self-regulation and can have a huge effect on how self-controlled a kid can be.
Let's take another call. We have Carol joining us. Hi, Carol. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Mike. And hey, Paul. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Go ahead. Thank you, Carol, for making it.
I'm glad that you guys are discussing this topic today, because my daughter was actually blessed by being handpicked for a mentoring program here in Philadelphia called Philadelphia Futures. Her mentor, Madeline Schwartz, who is an attorney, has been a blessing to our life. And I think, and I totally agree with your previous callers too, but I totally agree with what Paul is saying about the GRIT program, about if these kids are in an environment where they're able to have resources to things that otherwise they wouldn't have had resources to. I think it really helps them out, a great deal, so to speak, in regards to determining how their future is going to turn out, you know. So I'll take my response
Carol,
off the air.
Carol, let me ask you one quick follow-up question. What did the mentor bring into your daughter's life that was absent?
No.
What was the it?
Okay, well, the it is because she's still there in our life. She has brought, motivational encouragement to the field that my daughter is currently in as a broadcasting communication major, as well as law. So my daughter's thinking about taking law courses as well. But I've been truly blessed by their family, and not to mention my daughter is actually giving back, mentoring her younger sister, going to college, helping her get situated to do what it is she needs to do. So.
All right, Carol, sorry, now your line is breaking up, but thank you. That really clarified your call, and thank you for making the call. And, Paul, two follow-up questions. So mentoring relationships, sometimes we think of young kids, but they are sometimes very important in the lives of young adults even.
Yeah, so I think especially in adolescence, I think one thing that I saw both in terms of specific interventions that I've followed and in terms of the research is that adolescence is obviously a really difficult time in a lot of kids' lives. And I think especially for kids who grow up in adversity, it can be this moment where, you know, problems with impulse control that aren't such a big deal in a kindergarten classroom suddenly involve, you know, making bad decisions that can last the rest of your life, or conversely, making some really good decisions that can get you to college and last the rest of your life in a more positive way. And so I think that one thing that's clear to us is that the best way for kids to develop the kind of self-control and other character strengths that will help them make those good decisions comes through relationships. And they can get that in school. You know, a great teacher, a great coach, a great mentor within a school can make a huge difference in a child's life. They can often get that from family, but sometimes they can't. And that's where I think mentoring programs can be incredibly powerful. I read about this one program in Chicago called Youth Advocate Programs that worked with kids who were really most at risk in the city of Chicago. It didn't work for every kid. Sometimes, you know, the problems that these kids brought to this relationship were impossible for them to overcome in that context. But some of these kids just had really transformed lives by this close relationship that they developed, even though, you know, they were already 16, 17 years old.
And Paul, in your experience talking to parents all across the socioeconomic spectrum, where does the issue of character come into their minds? Is this something they're thinking about, how they instill character, how they develop their child's character? Or are they more concerned whether or not their kid can read or what all the great things is they know?
I mean, I think every parent is concerned about their child's character to some degree. I think what I worry about is that, and this is sort of the complication of using the word character. I purposefully chose to use that as you know, the word in my subtitle and the word that I used throughout the book, but it can be problematic because I think a lot of us think of character as something that is fixed. It's just something that is innate in us and it never really changes. And I believe in the researchers that I'm writing about are make a strong case for the idea that these character strengths are really malleable skills. They're skills that kids learn, that they can change themselves, that parents can help their children develop, and that teachers can help kids develop as well. So I do think parents worry about it, but I worry that sometimes they're just like, oh, he's that kind of kid or she's that kind of kid, rather than saying this is something we can work on.
And the research is hinting at that even things like optimism can be learned.
Absolutely. And then my sense is there's two times in a child's life where they are particularly, these skills are particularly malleable. One is in early childhood, in infancy. And there it's not so much about teaching optimism as just about creating a sort of strong, secure base for kids to feel better about themselves and more confident about the world. But then I think, again, in adolescence, there's this period where kids become what Martin Seligman, actually at University of Pennsylvania, calls metacognitive, where they can reflect on themselves, on the way they think, on the way they react to things. And interventions at that stage work in a very different way, where you can, I think, kind of guide kids through, just the way that chess teacher did, why do you keep making these bad decisions? In that case, it's not about, you know, why you keep losing your pawns. It's about why you keep getting in the fights with your parents, why you keep skipping class. And I think kids are able at that age to really reflect, and often, if they have the right kind of support, to make big changes.
Let's take another call. We have Sharon joining us from Wilmington. Hi, Sharon. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My main question is, have you seen a gender difference between grit, between a girl and a boy? I have a twin boy and girl, both obviously go to the same school but in different classes. And I don't know if you had done a study on the differences between the two.
All right, Paul, have you seen any research on gender differences? I know there is a lot of research out in terms of success and how kids do, but what about the specific question of grit?
You know, that's a really good question. I am sure that Angela Duckworth has an answer to that. But I don't know what the gender differences are in terms of grit. I do know that in her self-control research, she has showed that girls are more naturally have self-control than boys do, and it's part of why girls on average have a higher GPA than boys do. But I don't know how it extends to grit.
Now, in our classrooms, we talked a bit earlier about how this kind of research that you have described in your book is making its way into education policy, into our classrooms, maybe. But do teachers have time for this, especially when their objective is to make sure that the kids can score on these tests? I mean, does anybody have time for this stuff?
I think a lot of teachers would say no. I think it's absolutely true that especially as incentives for teachers become more and more intense, if their only incentive they have is to improve their students' scores on these pretty narrow cognitive tests, there is no incentive for them to work on these other skills. At the same time, I think that lots of teachers just know this intuitively, that these skills are important. Teachers, you know, throughout history, some of them anyway, have been really good at developing these skills in kids. And so I think it's still going on all the time, but I think in a systematic way, we really haven't developed a way to reward teachers for doing this. And we certainly don't have a great, you know, kind of curriculum to hand teachers and say, this is how you make your kids more gritty.
But are schools adopting certain, let's say, curriculum items where they say, okay, here is our plan to develop these strengths in our kids? I remember 10 years ago, there was a huge emphasis on resilience. How do we foster resilience in children? And that's, I think, what this gets to with a new name to it on some level.
I think you're right. I mean, I think a lot of schools are thinking about this, and a lot of schools want to try to figure out ways to do this. And I think some of them are experimenting with different methods and different models to do it. But I don't think we have the answer yet. I don't think any school knows how to do it. So the schools that I read about, Kipp and Riverdale in New York, are doing some pretty cutting-edge experimentation, and I think they may be onto some important solutions, but I don't think they've figured it out either. The reality is it's really hard to develop these skills. They aren't taught in the way that that academic skills are taught. You can't do, you know, curiosity worksheets. You can't, you know, do grit homework. But at the same time, there's lots of ways, I think, that any adults, teachers, parents, everybody can help develop these skills. It's just takes a lot of work.
Yeah. Let's take another call. We have Joe joining us from West Philadelphia. Hi, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've been listening, and I've been an avid listener for a long time. I'm also a teacher. I teach the arts. I teach dance. And what I wanted to bring to the table, that all of those qualities that your guest has espoused are inherent in the arts, the discipline, the focus, the sense of accomplishment. And I think that that's one of the things that has been taken out of the schools that allows the children to excel in a different way, because the teachers only do have a certain amount of time to get curriculum in. But by having this way of a child learning, it also fosters a lot of those qualities that you talk about for grit. And I, you know, like for your guests to talk about that, because it's important. And just like a company like Philadelphia, I'm reading that book on their founder, Joan Myers Brown. And this is something that she brings to her dancers, who not necessarily go on to have careers in the arts, but having that sense of accomplishment and that sense of problem solving that he talked about, knowing that there is something that you can work on and also address in your body.
Joe, thank you so much for that call, and you bring up a very good point, Paul, especially with arts programs always being the first ones to be cut.
I think you're absolutely right. I think there are lots of kids who through arts programs, especially if they've got a great teacher, a great instructor, can absolutely learn those skills in dance class and music class. I mean, to me, it goes back to what we were talking about in terms of sports, and I also think of it in terms of chess. You know, I think that there are ways, because so much of these skills are developed through relationships, I think that, you know, there's a way that we set up sports teams and chess teams and you know, dance and music classes as being about this intensive back and forth between an instructor and a student. And I think that is a big part of why they can be so character building, these projects. So I do think we need more of all those things, and kids need more opportunities to do things. But I also think that those give us some kind of model for teaching, you know, math and science and everything else. That when those sorts of relationships take place, even in a very academic setting, I think kids not only are going to learn the material in a really enthusiastic way, they're going to learn those character strengths as well.
And I want to return, we're slowly running out of time or quickly, and I want to return to the concept of toxic stress. That is getting a lot of attention, the impact on mental health, on well-being, on health outcomes in children. So do you feel that there is more attention being paid to that by policymakers? Is that entering its way into, you know, translating into programs and ways to help families?
I think it's beginning to, but I think I'd like to move a little more quickly. I think it's still at the stage where we're experimenting rather than having a lot of great, you know, citywide or statewide or nationwide programs that are helping kids in adversity deal with toxic stress. I spent a lot of time with a pediatrician in San Francisco, Nadine Burke Harris, who is working with a very disadvantaged population and was very concerned about health problems and mental health problems that these children were having, that, you know, her public health background hadn't prepared her to deal with, and so she really transformed her whole practice and her whole clinic in order to figure out ways to better deal with the effect of toxic stress in the first couple of years of life. So I think it can be done, but it's more than just sort of, you know, adding on one program here. I think it really is about rethinking how we give help and services to kids in the first few years of life.
And in a few seconds, politically, who does this kind of work appeal to, if at all, since it is an election year, the concept of character?
Well,
either side interested?
I really hope that both sides are interested. What I say in the conclusion of the book is that the message, the challenging message for liberals here, I think, is that character actually really does matter. Conservatives are right about that. But I think the challenging message for conservatives is that, you know, we can actually do something about it. It doesn't mean we need to do less in low-income neighborhoods. It means we need to do more.
And that's Paul Tough, author of How Children Succeed, and he joined us today here on Radio Times, and we thank him for that. And thank you for all of your calls. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Marty Moskowain, and you've been listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.